Call the Tax Committee meeting to order. Members, if you could please take your seats. Representative Abrams moves.
I move, Mr. Chairman, that House File 2498 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Is that with recommendation, Representative Abrams?
Positive recommendation. Be recommended to pass.
A positive recommendation.
Yes.
Okay. We'll listen intently. Representative Abrams, did you want to walk through the bill first? What action did you want to take first?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thought I would give a brief overview as to the process, and then there are various people here to talk about various provisions in the bill. Mr. Chairman and members, the process this year is, to some extent, we use last year's public finance bill as a base. There are a number of other provisions that came forward both by the Public Finance Institute, which we normally use as a base, and then other bills that were introduced by members. Representative Lencheski and I met on a number of occasions. There were no meetings that I had in which Representative Lencheski wasn't involved, and I think that this represents at least our best attempt to try to put together a public finance bill that would be, there may be some provisions that are somewhat controversial, but at least without any partisan controversy was at least the intention. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, the TIF article was not in the omnibus tax bill, and the TIF article, some of those provisions were moved to the public finance bill for a number of reasons. I do have an amendment that I would like to have put on so we can talk about the bill in the way in which I would like to, so I would like to move the A1 amendment. And this does reflect a couple of meetings that Representative Lencheski and I had with Mr. Michael. And some of it is technical in nature, but we'll certainly get to the substance of it as we're going through the rest of the bill.
Representative Abrams would move the A1 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct. Abrams?
Okay. You, as I said, Representative Abrams, I'm sorry, this is a technical amendment?
It's a little bit more than a technical amendment in that it reflects some items that came to the attention of myself, Mr. Michael, and Representative Lencheski in the last few days, and were not included in the bill that was introduced on May 5th. May I say that May 2nd?
So, Representative Abrams, did you want to adopt the amendment or did you want to discuss the amendment?
I wanted to adopt the amendment and then to discuss the provisions of the amendment when we get to the to that provision of the bill.
Representative Abrams moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like it. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, the motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll just go through the bill. There's a bill summary, and just go through the bill section by section, and when I need some help by people in the room who are here to advocate for various provisions, they can do so. Article 1, Section 1 of the bill does come from a bill last year that was included by Representative Hausman that dealt with the River Center. And this one deals with the data practices rules for the nonprofit organization created by the City of St. Paul to own and operate the River Center. And then I would call on the Public Finance Institute to try to take us through. Oh, he's in route, but the Public Finance guy's in route?
Yeah.
Okay, we will skip the public finance provisions in the bill. Why don't we go on to the Met Council?
That sounds like a good place to start.
Section 19. We have Mr. Diaz is here to take us through Article 1, Section 19 of the bill, dealing with two items, Section 19 and Section 20. I think that the chair may have some interest in these sections. So we do have Mr. Diaz here from the Met Council to discuss the Met Council bonding request for capital. It is $64 million, which represents $32 million we passed last year but didn't get through the process, and $32 million this year. But Mr. Diaz is here and can talk to the committee about those items. And Mr. Diaz, good luck.
Thank you. Representative Abrams, Mr. Chairman, Nacho Diaz, Metropolitan Council. First, I would like to thank Representative Abrams for carrying our bonding request for many years in a row and allowing us to make the necessary investments to keep the transit system going. I just want to make basically explain a little bit what this request is all about. We, as Representative Abrams indicated, this request really is a two-year request because we had requested $32 million last year, but since the public finance bill didn't pass, we never got those $32 million, and so we are requesting the $32 million we didn't get last year plus the $32 million for this year, so that would be a total of $64 million. This bonding authority is not for GO bonds. This bonding authority is for regional transit capital bonds that are repaid with a property tax levy that is raised through the communities in the transit taxing district inside the metropolitan area. So it's strictly communities within the metropolitan area. The investments that those $60 million would allow us to do are primarily oriented at maintaining the existing system. For the most part, what we're talking about is making very basic investments on the existing transit system, like, for example, replacing buses or refurbishing transit garages and things of that nature. There are a few expansion projects in the $64 million in the bus system, so maybe some expansion buses for suburban off-top communities, but for the most part, the vast majority of the money is used for the basic system. The money also is used to match federal money for at least an equal amount of federal money, and that match is necessary because the federal funds require a local match, and this is the only funding source that we have that allows us to match those federal funds. There are a series of categories of projects. There are vehicle-related projects. There are passenger facility projects, like, for example, park-and-ride facilities, transit stations, so on and so forth. There are communications equipment. There are safety and security equipment, and then finally garages and other types of facilities. Without Mr. Chairman, I would be prepared to answer any questions that you may have.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Chairman, a list of the projects are being handed out, and in the interest of full disclosure to you, Mr. Chairman, the provisions I think that are probably the controversial ones on the list, I think the other ones are not controversial, is rail cars for ridership growth for the LRT. That would be the third on the vehicles Metro Transit, $1.2 million. On the second page, about three quarters of the way down, is LRT Passover pedestrian walkovers, $250,000 in 06 and 07. In the garages and equipment, passenger counters for LRVs, which are light rail vehicles, and then LRT signals for single track reverse direction, $250,000. I believe that those are the items that would generate, if not to say that there may not be something else on the list that somebody may find fault with, but at least those that would probably be viewed with the most controversy, at least by the chair of the committee. So that's the Met Council presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Did I understand you, Representative Abrams, to say you were teeing it up for the chairman to hit it out of the park? Or?
Mr. Chairman, the idea is that if there are controversial issues in the bill, I want to get them on the table for people to understand that they're controversial, and just teeing it up for you, Mr. Chairman, and let you deal with it as you wish.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this the provisions that you're talking about, is that on page 9 going from 5 to 10 years?
Representative Vanderveer, those are issues for the Public Finance Institute, and the provisions we're talking about, Representative Vanderveer, are page 16, section 19, and section 20 and section 21.
So, Mr. Chair, would you prefer I come back to this or the author?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have Mr. Diaz at the table now, and if there's any amendments or anything that has to be done to this section, it's probably easier to do it now than later.
So let's return to that later. Mr. Diaz, the first question is that although you give us this list of what your intended purpose for the $64 million in capital expenditures under these Representative Abrams, I'm sorry, or Mr. Diaz, explain the nature of the bonds, I guess, a little bit more. Are they their revenue bonds, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, these are bonds that the council issue that are repaid with a property tax levy authorized by the legislature, and the property tax levy is spread over what is called the Metropolitan Transit Taxing District. The Metropolitan Transit Taxing District is all the communities inside an imaginary line which is inside the metropolitan area, and that includes basically the fully developed communities, and actually does not include some of the communities that are becoming fully developed, but like, for example, Ramsey or Andover or Lakeville or Farmington, but otherwise it includes, Mr. Chairman, all the other communities, the Bloomingtons, the Rich Hills, the Coon Rapids, et cetera, et cetera, and of course, you know, Richfield, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and so on and so forth. And so the levy is spread over those communities for the repayments of bonds. The second thing is there is a method to this $32 million a year. The $32 million a year that we are proposing is the amount that we can issue without increasing property taxes on the average taxpayer. And so there is a commitment by the council that has been made that we will only issue the bonds that will not require that an increase on that property tax levy of the individual taxpayer.
Mr. Diaz, do you have information about what the current level of indebtedness is on the bonds and what the repayment schedule is?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure I understand your question. Are you saying what is the total levy?
What is the total amount of indebtedness and what is the repayment schedule?
I'm going to try to answer the question. The repayment schedule depends on the asset that we are bonding for. So, for example, if we are issuing bonds for a 12-year bus, in other words, a bus that we expect that is going to last 12 years, then we issue bonds for 12 years. If we, for example, are issuing bonds for a park and ride, for example, which we expect would last at least 20 years, then we issue bonds for 20 years. The amount, I don't have in front of me the exact amount, but I believe that the levy, the total levy that we are proposing is about $35 million.
I guess, Mr. Diaz, the question is, what's the current level of indebtedness? In other words, how much are the outstanding bonds currently, and how much are you adding to that indebtedness level?
I'm going to throw a number and see if I'm wrong, and then Beth Whistler-Mandelson, who's our chief financial officer, will correct me if I'm wrong. I believe that our indebtedness, the total, is approaching a couple hundred million dollars, but I think I may be a little high.
If we could...
She's going to check my number. I think it is not quite $200 million, I believe, but it's approaching that, the total level of indebtedness for transit. But we'll double check that number for you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Diaz, the question then more specifically is that these are the proposed projects that you would expend the money on with the additional $64 million of capital. But the question is, are these the only projects that you would expend money on, or if some other need came along, can you change where you spend these monies?
Mr. Chairman, these projects, I mean, in order for us to spend money on projects, we need to have them in our capital improvement program, our CIP. And these are the projects that are in the CIP. I'm not going to suggest that if we have a major crisis, I mean, for example, let's say that we have a park and ride, but right now we are leasing the land and that somebody is going to kick us out of the land and that we needed to do something in order to remedy that crisis, that we would not do something to try to remedy that. So I'm not suggesting, but that would be an extraordinary exception, and that this is the list that we intend to spend the money on. And again, I want to make it clear that if there was a major crisis of that nature, or like, for example, we had, I don't know, a roof coming down in our garage, and that there was going to be a danger for the mechanics in the garage, that we would probably try to do something about it. But these are the projects that are in our capital improvement program.
Can you explain to me, Mr. Diaz, what the crisis was? And I believe it was June of 2000, or maybe it was August of 2003, when I believe you used capital dollars for state matching requirements or local matching requirements for the extension of the Hiawatha Light Rail line to the Mall of America?
Mr. Chairman, we did not spend, any of these regional transit bonds money for that project.
Mr. Diaz, where did you come up with the money then? Because it wasn't appropriated by the legislature.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We didn't spend state monies, and we didn't spend any of these regional transit capital funds. We used federal funds, and we used some local match in improper, I mean, in in-kind contributions from the Mall of America for part of the land that we're going to be occupying in the station. But we didn't use any of these regional funds for that.
Well, Mr. Diaz, let's say you didn't use any of these monies, but then in terms of juggling the money, you used federal dollars that were appropriated previously, were earmarked for bus purchases, correct? So you want to give us the
Chairman, I can explain why.
Why don't you give us the explanation of where you got the money,
yeah.
Then I'll understand better where
these
money is. I'll
explain to you how we spent this, where we found the money. Because in those 2 years, we have had basically less operating money that we needed and had been cutting back service. We didn't need to replace as many buses as we expected to replace originally. And therefore, we had a one-time opportunity to use some federal money, and we used that federal money for that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Diaz, maybe you could also explain to the committee where you found the additional, I think it was... I won't put numbers on the table. Where did you find the additional money for the local match for the North Star commuter rail project when the legislature had not appropriated nor approved the project?
Mr. Chairman, as you probably remember, that we contributed $2.5 million to the North-South Corridor at the request of the governor. The governor asked the Metropolitan Council to try to contribute $2.5 million to the North-South Corridor because there was a possibility or danger that we might lose $10 million in federal money. And there was a very clear understanding that the legislature would have to obviously fund the project as it did this year. And I don't think anybody was under any illusions that the project was going to move forward if the legislature didn't give it its blessing. But we contributed that $2.5 million. And certainly that money was not contributed from these funds either. That money was contributed from some reserves. And I'm not going to try to tell you the exact term to explain the reserve, and maybe Ms. Wilson Anderson, because I would probably use the wrong names. But if you're interested in knowing what reserves those were, I'm sure that Ms. Wilson Anderson can tell you the exact name of that reserve. But it certainly was not out of these type of money.
You want to give us a clarification as to where those monies were appropriated from?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Woodstrom Anderson. I'm the CFO for the Metropolitan Council. The reserves that we used for the North Star match, the $2.5 million, came from interest earnings on debt service reserves from bonds which have been paid off. So the bonds are completely paid off, and there were some remaining interest earnings on some debt service funds from those bonds.
And what would you, if this quote-unquote emergency hadn't arisen, what would you have normally done with that, the reserves from bonds that had been defeased or paid?
Mr. Chair, most likely we would use those reserves, we'd retain those reserves to for future debt service reserves related to similar bonds. So we do have arbitrage payments, other kinds of payments that we have against debt reserves on occasion, and what we would have likely done is left that money in the debt service reserve for other transit bonds.
You would not have used any of that money to pay down debt?
Mr. Chair, that would have been a decision the council could have made. We do have some reserves we are using to smooth our debt out, to try to do as Mr. Diaz said, and keep our property tax levy flat without an impact to homeowners as much as possible. We have used some of those debt service reserves for that very purpose. For that $2.5 million, likely would have stayed in the reserve, potentially be used in the future, but would have likely stayed in the reserve at this point in time.
Was there a request by the Metropolitan Council when the North Star project was under consideration this year to the Met Council be repaid the $2.5 million?
Mr. Chairman, we did not.
Can you give me an indication as to why, Mr. Diaz?
To tell you the truth, I don't know that I have an explanation. We just did not. I mean, the project needed $37.5 million. That was what the governor requested. And we didn't intend it to be repaid the $2.5 million.
So if I understand this correctly, essentially the $2.5 million came out of the property tax levy within the transit district, and that $2.5 million was taken to front local match money for the commuter rail project, the majority of which is outside the transit taxing area. So we're taxing people, property taxes within the Metropolitan Transit Taxing District, and then we never asked to be repaid.
Chairman, I believe that there are two statements you made that are not totally correct. Number one, I don't think these were property tax levies. These were interest earnings, and again, I'm not an expert in these technical issues, but I don't think there were property tax levies, there were interest earnings. The second thing, the 2.5 million...
Well, Mr. Diaz, interest earnings from what? Interest earnings from the bonds that you're authorized to repay under the
that's correct.
Levy. Well,
I mean, it's correct that but there was there was not the property tax levies themselves. There were interest earnings accumulated over time. The second thing is, I lost my train of thought for a second. Let me see if I can recoup it. I'm losing my voice, my train of thought, and I'm losing a lot of things lately. But let's see, what was the second thing you said that I don't think was... the second thing you said, Mr. Chairman, if I understood you correctly, maybe I didn't. The $2.5 million that we committed to the project are not intended to be used outside the taxing district. Is that what you said, that they are? They are not. In other words, the money is going to be used for property acquisition, matching the funds that the federal government will provide for property acquisition inside the taxing district. And that was very clearly stated in our agreements with the North Star Corridor Development Authority, that's how it would be spent, not outside the taxing district, but inside the taxing district.
How much of the commuter rail project is outside of the taxing district, Mr. Diaz?
Mr. Chairman, I would... the taxing district in that part of the world goes all the way to Anoka and Coon Rapids and that general area, so all the way to Big Lake. I would guess, I mean, I have never tried to measure that, but in terms of mileage, I would say that probably 50 to 60%, and I know there are any experts on North Star in the room, but I would say that at least 50 to 60% of the mileage is inside the metropolitan area, probably, something like that, but I'm not too sure. But clearly, I would say that probably the largest investments in property acquisition are going to be made inside the metropolitan area and inside the taxing district, because that's probably where the need for those properties are going to be. And again, I don't claim to be either an expert on all the details of North Star, but clearly the commitment we made for matching the federal money, the $10 million, for acquisition inside the taxing district.
Representative Vanderbilt.
If you were done, Mr. Chair. Mr. Diaz, what's the current operating deficit of Metro Transit?
Mr. Chair,
the current operating deficit, how much are you short? You're asking the legislature to make up part of.
Vanderbilt, our projected operating shortfall for the 2006-2007 biennium is about $60 million.
About $60 million?
$60 million, $60 million.
And you want to borrow another $64 million?
Mr. Chairman, yes, but again, I think those are two different issues. One is a capital borrowing, and the other one is an operating shortfall.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Diaz, are two different issues because you're not relying on the operations to pay them off, right? To pay this debt off, you're relying on some other income, and that income comes from property tax. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, a portion of the capital investment comes from property taxes. Another significant portion of the investment, capital investment, as I indicated before, comes from federal funds.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Diaz, as the chair, we found out from his questions, you didn't think about the $2.5 million. Is that just a drop in the bucket, or why wouldn't you want to get that back since there was bonding? The legislature was going to go and bond for this, for the capital costs of the train. It didn't. No one thought about the $2.5 million.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vanderveer, I don't know if anybody thought about the $2.5 million. I never said that nobody thought about the $2.5 million. Yeah. I said that we never asked for being paid back the $2.5 million because I don't think it was ever, I mean, when the governor requested the Metropolitan Council to contribute $2.5 million for the North Park Corridor, I don't think it was never said that we were going to get repaid. So the council at that point made that decision, whether people like it or not, made that decision not expecting to be repaid.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe this isn't for Mr. Diaz, but is there anybody here that could remind us who appropriates money in Minnesota? How does that usually go? Is that
Representative Abrams, did you want to take that bonus toss-up question?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, the general appropriations is made by the Minnesota legislature in a law that would be passed by the House, passed by the Senate, and signed by the governor. There are other funds that flow to various government or quasi-government entities, such as the Metropolitan Council. We give them some general authority to do certain things, and they make their appropriations. If the question that you're asking is directed towards Metropolitan Transit, the legislature does make an annual or biannual appropriation to the Metropolitan Council to be used for transit. Additionally, it has been the custom of the legislature in at least the last 10 or 12 years to give some authority to the Metropolitan Council to issue bonds within the transit taxing area, which are used to pay for capital projects. In addition, there are some federal funds that flow to the Metropolitan Council that the legislature does not have any direct control of. I guess we could pass a law in which we'd have control over it, but at least under the laws that are currently in place, the federal funds that flow to the Metropolitan Council are spent by the Metropolitan Council in ways that the legislature has authorized and is consistent with federal law.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I'd like to also make a very fine point here, which is that these bonds are being issued to support not only our own metropolitan transit system, in other words, I mean, the Metro Transit, but that these bonds are also used to support all other transit providers in the region, including Dakota County DART and the suburban opt-out systems like Minnesota Valley Transit Authority and Southwest Metro and so on and so forth, and Human Services Inc. in Washington County and Avoca Traveler and so on and so forth. So I want also to make it very clear that this has been a truly regional approach to funding these services. And by the way, I want to mention that Mr. Tom Paul, from representing the Suburban Transit Authority, is present here and would be glad to answer any possible questions regarding the specifics of their own projects. And that we have made a very strong effort to distribute this money in a fair and equitable manner, in which we are very proud, and this has not been just limited to Metro Transit, but to every single transit provider in the region.
So that money has been spent. Mr. Chair, Mr. Diaz, do you levy in counties where, or do you provide service in counties where you don't levy?
Mr. Chairman, we levy in Representative Vandeveer. We levy in all seven counties, but we don't levy in all the communities within the seven counties. We only levy in those communities, as I indicated before, which are within the transit taxing district, which is where we provide the main bulk of the services. But however, I would like to point out that we provide some services outside the taxing district too, which are, with a lengthy explanation, but are a leftover of the way in which our operating levy that was changed in 2001 worked. So for example, we provide transportation services through our MVEST appropriation and our general fund appropriation outside the taxing district in all of the rural portions of the metropolitan area. So DARTS provides services in the rural portions of Dakota County. Anoka Traveler provides services in the rural portions of Anoka County. Human Services Inc. provides services in the rural portions of Washington County. Carver County, Scott County, in all of those counties, there are provision services. However, those services are primarily services that are geared at providing that safety net to the people who are truly transit dependent. In other words, we do not provide regular route services in the form of commuter express bus services and things like that outside the taxi district.
Well, Mr. Chair, before we're done with this, I think we should get the $2.5 million back just in the interest of fairness to the people that actually paid for this. And I just think we should reduce the 64.4 by $2.5 million at least before the bill leaves the room. But we could maybe discuss that.
Well, we're on the section of the bill now. Representative Vandiver, you want to make that motion?
If staff could give me the line and page to do that on.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, the reference to the dollar amount of the bond authorization for the Metropolitan Council is on page 17, line 34. So if Representative Vandiver wants to reduce that by $64 million, he would delete the $64 million and insert $61,500,000.
That would be my motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to give members a little bit of perspective, and they're going to vote on this amendment how they want. The perspective is that under three governors, the Metropolitan Council has tried to get an open, ongoing appropriation, and I think that the questions that both you, Mr. Chairman, ask and Representative Vandiver have asked are fair and proper, because I've resisted going to an open and standing simply because I do believe that this issue does deserve oversight. However, what the effect of the Vandiver Amendment is it's not to give back to the people who put the money in, the $2.5 million. Rather, there is a list that's been put together of various capital programs for the Metropolitan Council that is carefully balanced between the opt-outs and the Metro Transit itself. For capital expenditures. What the effect of the Vandiver Amendment will be is simply that the Metropolitan Council is going to have to go back and take $2.5 million off of their capital list. Nobody gets benefited. The better thing to have done was when the capital investment bill was coming through to use $2.5 million of the state appropriation for North Star and to have that money replenished to Metropolitan Transit. So I don't understand how quite people are $2.5 million, how that money is being returned simply by having less bonding authority, but I'll certainly leave it to the members.
Further discussion to the Vandiver Amendment? Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vandiver.
The money should be repaid, and I think what Representative Abrams is saying is probably true, and I'm just not certain what the legislature can do when there's an end run around our intent, and this may not be the right answer, and I respect Representative Abrams' statements on that. However, I'm just wondering if maybe then if we took it out of here, the Met Council could check and see if the governor had it sitting around in his budget somewhere to repay it, but I'll withdraw my motion for now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
I do have an idea that I don't think it'd be drafted very easily now, but certainly be ready for Ways and Means, because like you, Representative Vandiver and Representative Krenke, I was concerned about using those funds for purposes other than the bonds, because obviously the people who paid in ought to have reaped the benefit from the arbitrage savings. So maybe possible for Ways and Means to have an amendment added to the bill to basically require any arbitrage or other interest earnings off of these bonds to be used solely for the purposes of in the future for these projects rather than try to undo what was done. But I do think, Mr. Chairman and Representative Vandiver, that you do bring up a valid point, and I think it's a point that I raised with Mr. Diaz back in August when I was not asked but informed what was going to happen, and I think I
expressed some sentiments very similar to yours, Mr. Chairman and Representative Vanderveer's.
Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it possible, I was just trying to ask Mr. Michael here, maybe he can tell us, that you could just amend the bill now, because the bonding bill has passed, to delete the $2.5 million from the bonding bill. Although it would certainly turn this into a controversial public finance bill, so I know, you know, you probably don't want to do that, but I agree with Representative Abrams that what you're trying to do, Representative Vanderveer, is, I agree with you, but I don't know that the particular language here gets us there. And I'm just listening to you and Representative Krenke explain this to me, and I'm sitting here just stunned. So I want to get that $2.5 back as well. But I don't want to make Representative Abrams' bill a very controversial bill on the floor. So,
oh, he's never had
one. You know, but Mr. Chairman, he has worked really hard to make this a non-controversial bill. And a lot of people have very serious provisions in here that many communities are relying on, but I agree with both you and Representative Prinke's line of questioning, and I just wonder if Mr. Michael has an idea how we might do something going forward but still not hurt Representative Abrams' bill.
Mr. Michael, do you have any legislative language up your sleeve?
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Abrams' suggestion to work on this on the way it, before it gets to Ways and Means, is probably the best idea. I mean, fundamentally, the problem you have is, you know, that you're dealing with $2.5 million that has to come from somewhere, and obviously the Met Council has counted on all of this money for the projects you see on the list. And, you know, over time, there may be some way to have them repay it back through interest earnings or something like that. But there, I mean, it's a real financial problem if you just were to deduct it from this or to take it out of some other monies that they have.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Michael, could you work on, before Ways and Means, some anti-arbitrage language or use of arbitrage? It's probably better called use of arbitrage fund language from this account, which at least will keep the problem from occurring in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you. Well, I think, you know, Representative Lincheski's not in Ways and Means, and that's kind of a disadvantage, but I think there are two issues. One is Representative Abrams, let it not happen again, but between now and Ways and Means, I think there's the issue of repayment. This was blatant. I don't think it was a minor oversight.
Well, since we've talked about that issue for a while, let's continue down memory lane on some of my favorite topics. On page 2 of your list, Mr. Diaz, the downtown Minneapolis transit advantages, it looks like $2.1 million. Can you give us an indication of what that money's for?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an exact description, and I certainly can get that to you, but typically what we're talking about here are some sort of work that we might do to facilitate the traffic of the buses. I mean, that might be things like, in, you know, maybe a little bit of a special lane for the buses at an intersection, or maybe doing some special thing with the traffic signals, or things of that nature. I mean, typical advantages are things like shoulder bus lanes, or special lanes for buses and things like that. So it's nothing terribly complicated or terribly difficult, but you, I mean, I hope you understand that we have thousands and thousands of buses converging on downtown Minneapolis at the end of the day, and that therefore providing some special provisions for layover of the buses out of the mainstream of traffic, or again, or some partial dedicated lanes to facilitate a turn or things like that. That's what we're talking about. So fairly innocuous thing. I don't have right now in front of me an exact list of what that would be, but my suspicion, we're talking about a series of very small projects that provide a little bit of a facilitation of the traffic of the buses.
So, Mr. Diaz, this $2.1 million doesn't have anything to do with the downtown Minneapolis circulator?
No, Mr. Chairman, it has nothing to do with the circulator.
My next question, Mr. Diaz, is I see you have in a couple of lines here, you have the fare box, you have regional ticket vending machines. Recently there was an article talking about the how your smart transit cards aren't working. Is this in relationship to that issue, Mr. Diaz?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. The smart card is not quite smart yet. We hope it will be, and we are still hoping that by July 1st we will be able to make it work. I also have to admit that we have had a lot of bumps along the way. Quite frankly, we are not very pleased with the whole thing. On the other hand, my experience over the years is that many times these high-tech products tend to overpromise and not be delivered, and I think that we are facing a case like that. And but we need to have a way to to get the fare box media, tickets and so on, to sell them to them. So I mean, it is indirectly related, but it's not necessarily the exact program that we're talking about. But I agree with you. I mean, it's been a very significant problem, and it's not working yet.
So, Mr. Diaz, how much has been expended on this program to date, and are the intended expenditures that are contained here, is this the
Mr. Chairman,
the total fix, or is
the
this
program? The program is a multi-million-dollar program. I want to remember that it well in excess of $10 million. I don't remember the exact number right now, but it's a very large program, and it was intended to affect all transit vehicles in the region, not only the metro transit vehicles, but also the several hundred vehicles that the suburban operators are operating. So it's a very large program, and quite frankly, expensive one. Certainly, these $250,000 are not even a small fraction of that program. I mean, certainly is not the one that is going to make it possible. The program itself has been, for the most part, funded from previous years, and I can provide you with a number, but I would say that it's at least $12 million, and I think it might be even higher than that. The total. Beth Wisdom Anderson tells me that it's $16 million the total. So it's well over, as I said, it is a large multi-million dollars program.
Mr. Diaz, is there any dollars, just glancing through the list, I haven't seen anything in here. Are there any money in here to install control points or turnstiles along the light rail line in Minneapolis?
Mr. Chairman, no, we don't have any. I want to call your attention so you talk about light rail. There is something that we were proposing here, which is passenger counters for the light rail vehicles we are proposing, because as you well know, there has been some controversy about whether or not we're getting all those riders or not. And so we were trying to provide automatic passenger counters that would take away the potential skepticism that people have about whether or not we are getting a lot of riders, which we think we are, but maybe there has been some skepticism about that. So we have an item about that, but not to provide turnstiles and other controls.
Representative Vandeveer, I think, has some documentation on that issue, don't you, Representative Vandeveer?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair, and maybe at some future meeting the committee would would like to view that. It only takes about 9 minutes.
So can you give us an indication, Mr. Diaz, what is passenger counting technology? Or
pardon me?
What is passenger counting? I mean, is this high-tech, like somebody standing in the car going 1, 2, 3, 4?
Chairman, these are automatic counters. So I don't think I would call that very high technology. I think it's basically as somebody goes through the door, coming into the car, they would be counted. I mean, there would be and that would be automatically done. And so at the end of the day, we would know how many people have gone through the doors and how many people use the system. And as you know, there has been some controversy as to whether or not we really have as many passengers as we say we have. So we thought that might be a way to put to rest that that question.
Yeah.
And as you know, as you see, it's a fairly small amount of money. So we think it's it's well worth doing.
Well, Mr. Diaz, it may be a small amount of money, but it's my understanding that Metro Transit is moving away from part-time transit police and hiring more full-time transit police in order that they may have more full-time transit officers on the light rail vehicles. So while you save capital dollars, it sounds to me like what Metro Transit is doing is incurring hundreds of thousands of dollars in additional labor costs by hiring full-time transit workers, full-time Metro Transit police to be on the Hiawatha light rail line. So you may save some money on the capital side, but what are you expending on the operating side?
Mr. Chairman, I think your statement is generally correct. I still think that, the trend in the industry has been not to install. I mean, I think we're talking about a different issue now. I mean, in other words, not the passenger counters, but whether we should have turnstiles and other controls so we can stop people. I think the clear trend has been not to have those controls, but rather to go to a honor system that people have to do proof of payment. And we have chosen to do that, as you are correctly stating, through our transit police. And obviously that's part of the operating cost. But it saves a lot of money in terms of the capital investment. And in addition, of course, of checking the fares, the police presence achieves other objectives too, I think. And I think my understanding, and I don't say that I have seen every single light rail system that has been implemented in the continental United States in the past 25 years, but I'm not aware of any light rail system, not heavy rail, but light rail system, that has implemented those controls. Heavy rail systems, like, of course, say, the subway in Washington, D.C., and so on, do have those controls, but I'm not aware of any, and I could be wrong, and so I'm not suggesting that there are none. Light rail systems that do that.
Okay. Representative Bowles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess I don't really want to turn this into the whole bill into a light rail debate, but I am curious about this issue. Mr. Diaz, I was wondering if you can provide the committee with any information regarding the success or lack thereof of the Metropolitan Transit Police in terms of the numbers of citations that have been issued to people not paying fares on light rail. I haven't seen those numbers before. I'm wondering if they exist.
But Mr. Chairman, the numbers exist. I really don't have them with me, but certainly the numbers exist on how many citations have been issued and what has been the result. But I wouldn't even try to venture to tell you what the numbers have been. My general impression has been, and I think it's not just in Minnesota, where people are very nice and very polite, but I think all over the country, that the general sense has been that there is an enormous amount of compliance with respect to the fair paying, the paying affairs. But I don't have specific numbers. I don't know if Mr. Shetland went and tried to confirm those numbers, and we may be able to give you those numbers before the end of the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, you may have said this, but I wasn't quite sure. Are you aware of any other rail systems, light rail, if you want, that operate the same way that you do as to how they watch over the use of the folks that come on there, that they have tickets and so forth? Anybody else operate a similar system? Did before you started up your system, did you look anywhere in the world and say, aha, we have successful systems here in Philadelphia, New York, Boston, London, somewhere? And you said, that looks like the best, you make some kind of a business decision that this is the best way to operate our system here. You didn't give any thought to that, I don't suppose. You just plugged it in and said, dartboard, we won't have any, and we won't have any turnstiles. And you have a little background on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, the reason I have so many white hairs is because we've done a lot of thinking about those things. We've been thinking about these things for many, many years. And clearly the reason why we made, as you said, a business decision to go to a barrier-free system as opposed to one that would have all those controls is because after thinking about it and looking at what the people have done, we came to the conclusion that that was the best business decision. And as in any other business decision you have, there are always pros and cons, and I'm not going to say that, another option would be absurd. I'm not at all suggesting that. But it was our feeling that it was going to be a better fit for the type of operations that we were talking about, to have a barrier-free proof of payment system, and having one that would have a very complex and with a lot of barriers and turnstiles and all things like that to do the fair.
Mr. Chairman, yes. Then, if someone didn't like your business decision, they could whine and carp at you and suggest that you made the wrong decision and we ought to micromanage it. Is that what we're saying here? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Earhart, I don't have any comments on that.
Thank you.
Amen.
Well, Representative Earhart, a business decision that was resulting in a $60 million shortfall in an operating is, I don't think, is, I think there's some.
Wait a minute, Mr. Chairman. That has nothing to do with what is happening here. The MVES transfer, which is no longer available because of the MVES shortfall, is what the shortfall, what causes the shortfall.
Mr. Chairman.
Anyway, Representative Abrams, maybe we need to move on to the bill. Yeah. But anyway.
Representative Earhart, if you buy a new car, the MVES shortfall wouldn't be quite as high.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I'm also guilty of driving a 10-year-old car, so
Chairman,
part of the problem.
If you bought a new suit, the sales tax shortfall would be.
Okay. Mr. Diaz, could you explain what the language change in Section 20 on page 17 of the bill does?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Let me go quickly to it. Page, could you repeat my...
Page 17, Section 20.
Section... subdivision 1F, are you talking about subdivision 1F or 1F, 1K, and so on?
Section 20, lines 22 through 27.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. basically, Mr. Chairman... what we're indicating here is that old authorizations, in other words, the ones that have been authorized before this year, in other words, before January 1st of 2005, we would not be able to use those obligations for anything having to do with light rail. But what I'm suggesting, Mr. Chairman, is that light rail is part of the system today, and that therefore we may have, like we have indicated in the list that Representative Abrams brought to your attention a series of investments that are going to be necessary over time. That we have a system up there, that there is going to be wear and tear, and that we're going to have to do some very basic investment over time, and that therefore we cannot have a blanket prohibition saying that no money can ever be spent on capital investments on the light rail line that is already in place. And so that's why we are hoping that we will have this change in the language that would allow us to make some very basic investments on the light rail line if we need to over the in the future.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Chairman, some of this language was added at my insistence because what the council came in with was just a total repeal of the language that you had. And if you also go down to Section 21, it refers to the Transit Master Plan and the Transit Capital Improvement Program. Well, this list that's been handed out, member, is a Transit Capital Improvement Program, and there are like three or four items that I did highlight to you, and the reason for the language in Section 21 is to limit them to the items within this Transit Capital Program. They wanted a total repeal, and I said I'm willing to carry what's in the improvement program and no more, and I felt that I was trying to limit some of the controversy by doing that, Representative Krenke. Just a thought.
Mr. Chairman, we were very comfortable with the suggestion that Representative Abrams made to us, and we are fine with this language.
Well, Representative Abrams, as I understand this, what this language does is say that no previously issued bonds could be used for the obligations or construction costs on the Hiawatha corridor, but any of the $64 million could be used for either the Hiawatha corridor, the North Star corridor, the Central corridor, Red Rock, or anything else that's in the master regional transit master plan. Is that correct,
Mr. Chairman? I'd say yes, but. And the but is that this is an annual event in which these bonds have to come through the legislature. There will be oversight on an annual basis. And let me assure you that there are members who care about a lot of the items on this list. And if they get bumped for something else, they will be here ripping the Met Council apart for not following the process that led to the list. You know, not only for the opt-outs, but for the system itself, for you know things like the park and ride and the Dyna, the bus shelter in St. Louis Park, you know, et cetera, various garage facilities, et cetera. If in fact this list isn't followed, I would suggest that the Met Council will have a very, very difficult time in getting any additional authorization through the legislature.
I'm not seeing that.
Well, Representative Abrams, I guess I don't really concur with that because when there was need to find additional matching money for the light rail extension in Bloomington, they could find the money without legislative authorization or approval. When they wanted to find $2.5 million for local matching money for the North Star project, they found that without legislative approval. And so I think that it's quite obvious that if Metro Transit, in concert with the governor, wants to allocate money for any transit project in the Twin Cities, that it can be done or is done under this governor. It seems to be it's happened twice, so it doesn't seem to me that there's much that the legislature has done to exact any measure of accountability on what funds are expended for what purpose with Metro Transit. So, again, that's just one legislator's opinion, but Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Diaz, and I apologize if you've already explained this. If you did, it went right over my head, which wouldn't be the first time. How is the capital improvement program list put together, and how can it be changed? In other words, we have a list in front of us now that contains a number of projects, some of which I think are great projects, some of them which benefit my area. I'm just curious, in light of what Representative Abrams said, how is the list put together and how is it changed? Is it a simple vote by the Met Council to approve this list and a vote to change it as well?
Well, Mr. Chairman, obviously it requires a vote by the Metropolitan Council of Mexico. But also, quite frankly, as Representative Abrams indicated, there are a lot of other organizations that are interested in this list. And as if you read down the list, you see Anoka Bus Replacement, Carver Bus Replacement, Plymouth Bus Replacement, Edina Park and Ride, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, if we were not delivering the goods that we are promising, and technically you're right, I mean, the council could, you know, change the capital improvement program, you can be rest assured that Mr. Paul from, you know, Suburban Transit Authorities, or representatives from the Anoka Traveler, or representatives from other Maple Grove Transit or whatever would be pounding at our doors and probably at your doors to say, wait a minute, we were promised, you know, new buses, we didn't get them, or we were promised a park and ride, we didn't get it, or we were promised, you know, another facility and we didn't get it.
Thank you for that explanation, and again, there, I don't think I have a problem necessarily with any of the programs on here, but I guess I do have a bit of a concern, particularly with the new language in Section 20, that if we are authorizing the Metropolitan Council to now go issue bonds for rail projects, that the council could say that Maple Grove Transit getting too much money here, so we're gonna take a little bit from them, and we'll maybe take a little bit from Southwest Metro as well, and you know, not enough to cause a whole lot of outrage from any one particular group, but we can come together with a pool of $10-12 million and go bond for a rail project, whether or not I might think that's appropriate. It seems that that's what this language authorizes the council to do now.
Well,
if they have some concerns about that.
Mr. Chairman, one thing I want to call to your attention is that the $32 million bonding level per year that we are requesting, quite frankly, is significantly lower than what transit providers, transit system would like to see. And I mentioned to you that in previous issuances, we have said numbers like $45 million, $54 million, and so on and so forth. So $32 million is a really tight number, very, very tight number. And I can assure you that if those Maple Grove Transit and those Southwest Metro and so on and so forth could, they would like to see a lot more projects in this list than you have right now. And the same way is true of Metro Transit and others. And so we are going to try to be playing around and fooling around with this list. I don't think it will take a lot. You might think that if we could, you know, take a little bit here and a little bit there, I think you would see a really outrage and outcry if that was going to occur. But again, this is a very tight list, which is already, quite frankly, much less than what all of the transit providers would like. And what we've done is that we worked with them and tried to reach a consensus where people understand that maybe we don't have all the money in the world to spend, but at least that we have done it in a fair and equitable manner, and we have distributed that money throughout the entire metropolitan area in a manner that people understand that we have done the best job we can with the limitation that we have established, which is $32 million, in order to maintain that property tax levy without, you know, without increasing that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Diaz.
Members, at this time, Chair will move the AE7 amendment. I need to make a slight change to the amendment on the I'll let staff read the amendment here as or the change in the amendment. Mr. Stone.
Mr. Chairman, on the A7 amendment, on line 2, it should read page 17, lines 22 to 25, delete the new language. It should also read on page, then a new sentence, page 17, line 26, strike in the, and page 17, line 27, strike everything before the period, and then delete line 5.
What?
Mr. Chair?
On the A7?
Oops, I did mean.
Could we get that again, please?
This is on A7? Yes,
ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, the A7 amendment was drafted to remove Section 20. So instead of removing Section 20, this would then amend Section 20 by removing the new language and then striking existing language on lines 26 and 27 that say in the Hiawatha Corridor.
Members, the intent of the amendment is quite simple. It is to say that the council can't use any of the either past or current obligations for the construction of light rail. Representative Anderson. That's what you see is subdivision 1F. Mr. Michael, you want to tell us what subdivision 1F is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, if you look at section 20 of the bill, it is amending subdivision 1F. Under the chair's amendment, I think the simplest thing to say is it would read the council may not issue obligations for construction of light rail transit. Under current law, it's prohibits issuing bonds for Hiawatha Corridor, whereas this would be a general prohibition.
So, members, my intent here is that we would say that the, again, we would change the language such that the council cannot use either past bonds or these new issuance of $64 million for the construction of light rail. Now, members, the reason I would argue in favor of the amendment is that we've had two instances where the legislature has not authorized or approved the either addition or construction of, I guess it wasn't really construction, it was planning money, land purchases. Might be some fine points here as to what they've actually done with the money, but members, I just think that this legislature should approve construction obligation dollars for light rail projects rather than the Met Council using these dollars to go out and do it without legislative approval. So whether I'm, as I said, the light rail line is up and running, and even though I'm not a central corridor that is constructed, but I think if you're going to construct it, I think that this legislature should indeed authorize or be giving the approval for the expenditure of the dollars, not allowing the governor to lean on his appointees of the Met Council to go do it without legislative authority. Representative Mulroney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Diaz, maybe I didn't understand it, but it seemed to be that this is not contrary to what you said the intent was. Maybe I missed something. Or is this okay with?
Mr. Chairman, the problem with the amendment, in my view, is that it has it basically prohibits us from doing any expenditure out of the $60 million for anything related to the Hiawatha Corridor. In other words, if we need to fix something in the Hiawatha Corridor that goes wrong, or like we suggest in this list, we want to buy some automatic passenger counters to know exactly how many people are using the line to do, you know, better understanding what it is. That we cannot use that because this prohibits. I mean, in other words, in my view, the problem with the amendment is that it pretends that the line isn't there. And the line is there. And, you know, we can pretend that it isn't there and we can go for another year or two without doing anything with the line, and we can pretend that it isn't there. And if that's what we want to do, that's fine. And obviously we will comply. I think we have been forthcoming this year and telling you that the line is a reality and that we need to do something there. And as a matter of fact, we have listed the things that we think we need to do. If the legislature tells us that no, we cannot do that and continues to maintain the old prohibition. I think here there is a very fundamental question, which is construction. We do not, depend what you call construction. We don't intend to use this money to build the Central Corridor. We don't intend to build this money to extend the Hiawatha Corridor into Dakota County. But the line is there. It needs to be maintained. It exists. And pretending that it isn't there and that we're not going to ever make an investment on it is probably not very realistic. But we will obviously follow whatever the legislature tells us to do.
Representative Mulroney.
Chairman, just as a follow-up, maybe I'm missing something. It says right now, I thought that you can't use it for construction in the Hiawatha Corridor. This would prevent capital expenditures. What is different? Is the capital expenditures then different from construction, and how? What?
Mr. Chairman, my concern is that any capital expenditure is going to be considered construction. I mean, in other words, if we need to fix a platform because something happens to the platform, somebody could say, oh, you are constructing. And if we put passenger counters on the vehicle, somebody would say, you are constructing. And if we do any of the things that we are proposing here, and the list explains what they are, like, for example, providing a local match for rail cars, because we have a lot more riders than we expected to have, that would be perceived as construction. And if we do some pedestrian facilities that for safety purposes appear to be necessary, that would be considered construction. So what we were trying is to call to the attention of the legislature that old prohibition, which I think was clearly intended to say, we don't want this money to be used for the construction of the line. And we didn't use it for the construction of the line. Now, because once the line is constructed, is kind of can be extrapolated and say you cannot expend any money, capital money, on the line. And we are going to need to spend money on the line sooner or later.
Well, Mr. Diaz, I believe there was a purchase of additional three cars, was there not, within the last 6 months? How were those cars purchased?
Mr. Chairman, we're in the process of procuring three vehicles. And those vehicles were being purchased in part through Hennepin County contribution, and in part with some of the money that had not been fully spent of the original construction cost of the project.
So, Mr. Diaz, if I'm following this process correctly, you extended the line without legislative approval. You found the money to go do that. You've been able to find the money to purchase an additional three cars without legislative approval. But now you're telling us if we change this line, you won't be able to put in passenger counters because they might be construed as construction on the line. Mr. Diaz, I'm having a little hard time following the logic here of saying that a passenger counter installed on a car is construction, but the extending the line another 4,000 feet, I believe it was, changing the alignment and extending it 4,000 feet. That wasn't construction, and therefore you didn't use any bonding money. So
no,
it seems to me, Mr. Diaz, that you've been able to do whatever you wanted to do, regardless of what the legislature did or didn't do. So it seems to me that you'll find the money to do what you want to do, regardless of what the legislature says.
Mr. Chairman, the first thing, I never said that the extension of the line into the Mall of America was not construction. It was construction. What I said is that we didn't use any of these regional bonds to do that, which is different. Obviously, extending the line into the Mall of America instead of stopping it across the street was something that resulted in construction, and I never denied that. And the other thing I would like to mention is that there has been clearly, we have done some of those investments without using these bonds or without using state money, because there have been some unusual circumstances as indicated before. The extension of the line into the Mall of America was possible because of the downsizing we were doing in the system. We had one-time federal money that we could use. For example, the fact that Hamilton County has been able to make available money for the vehicles doesn't mean, and they have been good enough to do that, doesn't mean that we can continue somewhat begging for money so we can maybe put the walkway over a certain spot that is dangerous and where people might have a safety problem, and we continue to go to, I don't know, Hamilton County or the city of Minneapolis or somebody else to try if we can get some money to do those things. So, Mr. Chairman, we've done those things, I agree, but I don't think that we can argue that in the future we're going to have to continue making investment on the line because it's here. Whether people, you know, agreed with the concept or not, or think it was worth doing, the line is here, and it's not going to go away.
Well, I have another suggestion from staff here so that we don't continue to argue about what has or may need to happen on the Hiawatha Corridor. Representative Abrams, would you agree with a change that would essentially take out the word on line 26, take out the word in and insert the word outside? So then we would be talking about that the council couldn't expend any capital, investment couldn't be made outside the Hiawatha Corridor. Representative Abrams, does that sound like maybe a peace agreement here amongst those who are pro and those who are con?
I see my Anoka County friend signaling no, but at least for this author's needs and today, you know, I think it's fine, simply because we have a list of projects in which the Metropolitan Council says the dollars are going to be expended. On the list are three items, and there's a defrocked bond council. The language that is in the bill would mean, in your amendment, Representative Krenke, would mean that I would be unwilling to issue an opinion that they could buy rail cars for Hiawatha, for instance. What your amendment basically says is that this list is fine, not that you like the list, but that the list is fine, but you don't want the money to be expended in North Star or Central Corridor or Red Rock or the others. So, for purposes of today and for purposes of this bill, I think the language is fine.
Mr. Chairman,
I think that's the change that you suggested.
If I may comment on that, at the risk of being shot when I go back to the farm or I run into somebody else, I would tend to agree with Mr. Abrams that the purpose of today and for this year and for what we're asking, your language would be reasonable, I think, at this point. Because I think it would at least acknowledge the reality that the line is here. We were not intending to build the North Star Corridor with this money. I can assure you that was not our intent. So I think your suggestion is reasonable, and I hope I don't get shot when I go back home.
Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I hope you're listening here to what was just said. It's for this place and this time this would be okay. But, you know, and Mr. Diaz, this isn't about pretending that the line isn't here. We know the line's here. This is about oversight. And this is about an agency with a pretty long record of doing end runs and getting money any way that it wants to, and it is our job to have some oversight here. And I was talking to an agency employee, not your agency, last week, and they said, well, you'll be here a while, but we'll be here forever. And the whole concept of, you know, of us trying to keep track of this is very, very difficult. But members, if we let this bill out of here without extracting a consequence, I think we're dumber than they think we are. And I would just say that, you know, we need, obviously, to tighten up on this. And I would do this on any project or with any expenditures. It's not about the light rail anymore. It is here, Mr. Diaz, and we understand that. But this is about oversight, and this is about pretty obvious expenditures that were not approved by the legislature. I think they...
My understanding from staff is that the chair will withdraw the A7 amendment and offer an oral amendment that on page 17, line 26, delete the word in, insert the words outside of. Anyway, let me just withdraw the amendment and let staff work on drafting a new amendment. And as we move on to other questions or other issues, I think we've gone around the barn a couple of times on this one. Representative Rukavina.
Sir, I just wanted to ask you if us real guys have been misbehaving so bad that you're torturing us for a reason here today, because... you know, we like to get home. It's the opening of fishing. The governor's up near my house. Not that I'm going to go visit him, but, you know, just keep an eye out so my place doesn't get burned or robbed or something. And
Representative Rukavina, you haven't been misbehaving such that we would want to torture you any further with this Metropolitan Council debate, but situation is we do need to move the public finance bill, and I think, as everyone is aware of now, Monday after session, we've scheduled the Representative Gunther's casino. I think it's going to be the first gay marriage here in the Minnesota legislature between Representative Biskins and Representative Gunther. That's what I heard. But anyway, the...
Mr. Chairman,
so we need to move on.
There are some controversial provisions in the public finance area that will engender some discussion, but I think, and Representative Lanchesky probably would agree, that most of the other parts of the bill are fairly non-controversial. So hopefully there may be another half hour, 45 minutes worth of frivolity, Representative Rukavina, and then we're on to the non-controversial stuff.
Mr. Chair, is there anything in here about the RRRB?
Mr. Chair, there is, and we hope to have some more.
Okay, members, Representative Abrams, let's move on so we can deal with some other non-controversial items.
Why don't we bring the Public Finance Institute up here, and they can go through most of what remains in Article 1 of the bill outside of the River Center project, which I think is non-controversial. See, you're not Mr. Rochelle. What happened to him? Is there a deadline that he has to get some bonds?
He retired from this position.
Welcome to the committee. Could you please state your name and who you represent for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Lynn Endorf. I am the Legislative Vice President of the Minnesota Institute of Public Finance. a nonprofit organization consisting of professionals who work in public finance, Carrie.
Start with section two. I'll just pull section by section. Also, my CIP.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Our concerns are with provisions of the bill that are kind of scattered throughout the bill. And with your permission, I'd go through those and identify which provisions are the ones that we are concerned with and discuss those.
Okay.
Our first provision is Section 2, and according to my copy, that's page 2, line 27. This is a provision to amend the provision relating to permissible investments for municipal funds to allow, in addition to United States banks and domestic branches of foreign banks and insurance companies, United States or Canadian banks, to be providers of guaranteed investment contracts, to also provide for guaranteed investment contracts by domestic affiliates of any of those entities. The problem, Mr. Chairman, is that there are a number of highly rated providers of guaranteed investment contracts who don't meet the current criteria under this law, and we're artificially limiting our the universe of guaranteed investment contract providers, and we're trying to deal with that. There is a provision that requires that any provider be rated in one of the two highest rating categories by a national rating agency.
Other provisions?
Next provision, section 2, page 3, line 1, is a provision that would add to the definition of special levies that would be accepted from levy limits if we had them. To add at page 5, line 35, levies for purposes of a storm sewer improvement district.
Okay. Any questions, members?
Okay. Next, there are three sections of the bill, not necessarily right together, that cover basically the same territory. Sections 5, Section 7, and Section 8 all deal with equipment financing for counties, for home rule charter cities, or statutory cities. The changes are to increase the permitted term of such a borrowing from 5 years to 10 years to more closely correspond to the useful life of the type of equipment that might be being purchased. Fire trucks are the prime example. They have a useful life often of longer than 5 years. And it also would clarify the language regarding the ability to finance computer software.
Okay, Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, on the computer software issue, there was some legislation that passed in 2003 dealing with the issue. The language didn't quite work, and there was a sunset of this year on it. So the way that this was modified in the amendment that was adopted, the A1 amendment, is it does give it a two-year window from the enactment until July 1, 2007, so that we do have some oversight over the computer software issue that has traditionally been an issue. And
It's basically giving them what they thought that they got back in 2003 as far as to see how it works. On the CIP notes, I would note that you cannot get a bond council to issue an opinion for equipment, for bonds longer than the useful life of the equipment. So even you're moving from 5 to 10 years, if there's a piece of equipment that's only going to be good for 5 years, useful life of 5 years, you can only issue the notes for 5 years.
Further question?
Well, Representative Abrams, the situation of the clarification here for original operating system software, is that what you're speaking of? And I guess, Representative Abrams, isn't this a, you're saying this is in current law with a sunset? Just a little further explanation, I guess.
Mr. Michael could talk about how the language was confusing that passed in 2003 and how the language has been changed, and then we're basically giving them the ability to have software other than the original operating system software to issue capital notes for this purpose. But Mr. Michael can give you the technical reason for the language.
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this authority did pass in 2003, and it was a Senate provision, and they had this language that said that it was authorized for original operating system software, and I think it was unclear to everybody whether that meant that you had to buy actually the computers with the software to mean that it's original operating system software. That sort of implies that it's the first set of software that you have for the equipment. And what the proponents of this had always intended was not necessarily consistent with that, because oftentimes we're talking many times mainframe and mini computers, big systems, and they sometimes are using existing machinery or they're buying some new machinery, and it's oftentimes they're buying the machinery from one vendor or the equipment from and the software from somebody else. So it just, as a practical matter, I don't think it worked in the way that it was intended. And so that's the problem that the Institute is now coming forward to try to solve. And as Representative Abrams indicated in the original bill, this would have sunset this July 1st. And in the author's amendment, aside from what the bill does is to say it applies to any software, whether it's bundled or unbundled with equipment. And then the author's amendment just sunsets that 2 years from when the current sunset is.
Let's continue then. Other provisions?
Section 6 on page 7, line 3, that is simply a language change to make it clear that for acquisition of development rights in the form of conservation easements, you can only acquire them, you can't better them. And that language made little sense to begin with, so it's a point of clarification. I'm on to section 9 on page 10, line 4. This is simply an extension of the sunset for the provision relating to establishment of special service districts. And section 10 adds notification provision with respect to that, to the establishment of those special service districts. Section 11 is an extension of sunset for housing improvement areas, and section 12 is a notification provision relating to that establishment provision as well. If there are no questions about those, I'm on, Mr. Chairman, to section 15 on page 12, line 27. And this is a provision that would extend the permissive maturity for general obligation housing revenue bonds from the current 30 years to 35 years if the housing project is an elderly housing project, or 40 years for other obligations. The problem here is that there are some federal programs available for assistance of housing that would allow for obligations going out as long as 40 years, and our statute is doesn't permit corresponding bond issue term. Then I'm on to section 16 on page 14, line 29. This is a provision that would allow other types of revenue bonds, economic development revenue bonds, to have a permissible maturity of 40 years rather than the current 30 years. If there are no questions about that, I'm on to section 24, page 19, line 14, the definition of what constitutes net debt for Minnesota municipal bonds, and we're recommending that we add to the list of bonds which are exempt from the debt limit, bonds issued to pay judgments against municipalities. Then section 25, page 20, line 17, that's and section 26 and section 27 are all very technical in that they add a semicolon to make the in each of those provisions. Section 28 on page 21, line 24, amendments to the capital improvement program bond issue statute that was enacted a couple of years ago for cities. Counties had this authority for a number of years. It was enacted a few years ago and changed to allow cities to do this. We're suggesting a few enhancements to that program. The first one is to allow metro area towns and larger towns to have access to this authority, to add town halls and libraries as permissible capital expenditures or capital improvements, and a lot of these amendments are technical because we've added towns to the, so we replaced cities wherever it appears with municipality. We've done nothing with the reverse referendum provision, but we have made a technical correction in section 31, page 23, line 27. We've made a technical correction because when the bill was enacted a couple years ago, it said that it tied the limit on annual debt service on this issue to a percentage of the market, of the taxable market value of property in the county. We have changed that to provide that it's a percentage of the taxable market value of property in the municipality. We have also changed the provision with respect to what constitutes net debt to provide that it's net, it counts as net debt for municipalities with a population of 2,500 or more. And we've also added a provision that would allow joint action by municipalities, that is cities and between cities and cities, cities and towns, in which they could, if each of them went through the reverse referendum, the hearing and reverse referendum process, they could allocate the both the annual debt service limitation and the net debt amongst them.
Okay.
And that's those are the provisions with which we're concerned.
Any questions? If not, thank you very much, Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I'll quickly go through the remainder of Article 1 so we can...
Well, Mr. Chairman...
Representative Davis.
Before the gentleman leaves, did we vote to take care of his semicolon?
When you vote for the bill, the semicolons are taken care of, Representative Davis.
I'm with you. I'm concerned.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Representative Abrams.
Very quickly through the rest of Article 1 so we can let the rural members get home. There is an increase in Section 4 of the spending limit for appropriations for societies for prevention of cruelty to animals from 50 cents to a dollar. That was part of the bill last year as a Representative Norris provision. There are two abatement provisions, general law modifications. One allows the use of economic development abatement for historic and heritage preservation. The second increases the duration limitation from 10 to 15 years if all three taxing districts approve, and from 15 to 20 years if one or two districts approve. Going further, Section 32 comes from, Representative Solberg and Representative Sertich. Representative Rukavina may have an interest in school refunding of some bonds. It extends the authority to use taconite production revenues for refunding bonds. It's a way to save some money for these school districts and seemed like a good idea. Section 33 from Representative Westrom deals with the Lakes Area EDA. And that was a provision last year. Section 34 authorizes the City of Bemidji to extend the duration of tax abatement for the Fairgrounds District by 4 years. As I mentioned earlier, there's a general law change, this provision kind of gets caught. City of Bemidji kind of gets caught if you don't do this in that they do have a deficit, and it doesn't seem fair that others on a going forward basis would have 15 years and Bemidji would have 10 years, and they get caught in some debt that they issued. Section 35 comes to us from Representative Rukavina. I believe it was in the bill last year dealing with the town of White, dealing with areas that were annexed by the city of Bowabic. Section 36 is a staying high gherkin provision for the Sauk River Watershed District. They're getting less than a quarter of what they asked for, but they're happy. Section 37 is the River Center provision that was in the bill last year that I mentioned. There is another provision in Article 1 that I can't find right now. Section 41, that was part of Representative Osmond's bill that I've had an opportunity to meet with the Met Council and Representative Lencheski and staff about dealing with the credit enhancement program. There is only one outstanding, and there is enough layers of protection for these bonds that it would never become a general obligation of the taxpayers of the metropolitan area, so it seems to me to be make some sense. On to Article 2, and I'm going to ask...
Representative Abrams, okay. Before we leave Article 1,
sure.
I think we I never heard an explanation of Section 14.
Oh, 14. Let me
exception
get that.
To competitive bidding.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay. That's an important section. Last year, members may recall that there was a provision that was passed... an attempted law that was passed on the House floor and the Senate floor by Representative Kelleher that was vetoed by the governor. And during the interim, there has been an agreement reached by the governor's office and Representative Kelleher and the city dealing with this rather unique facility in which there is condos above a... transit facility, and the government is financing it. If you take a look at the conditions here, it deals with the parking ramp, and the federal government does have a large share of it, and it is language that was developed to take care of the one situation. It is my understanding and that the governor's office is supportive of it, and Mr. Michael can talk about the mechanism. but it was a bill that was vetoed last year that Representative Kelleher had. But I thank you for that. And above that is a utility joint venture. I don't think you like that provision, Mr. Chairman, but it seemed that Representative Kelleher has made a number of concessions here, and it does only provide to the deal with the one situation.
Any other questions or issues on Article 1? If not, Representative Abrams, Article 2.
Well, I have Mr. Michael go through the Article 2, I think, until Section 15, where we get into some of the special laws. These are mainly technical in nature, some of which were offered by the Office of State Auditor, and maybe Mr. Michael can get through them quicker than I can.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll quickly go through this. As Representative Abrams indicated, these provisions were, almost all of them were developed as part of the TIF technical bill process, that's where it's basically a group that includes representatives from cities, practitioners, the Office of State Auditor, and county representatives. And most of these are, if not technical, certainly minor in nature. Section 1 changes a restriction on in the special cleanup grant law that originally was in place when there was a state aid offset for tax increment, and those projects that got cleanup grants were exempted from that. Since that offset was repealed in 2001, this repeals the TIF restrictions on those. Section 2 and a number of other provisions restructure the housing district market value limits that in response to a lawsuit in Minneapolis that was settled. Essentially what it does, I won't go into all the details, but it essentially repeals the old market value test, because all of the practitioners were essentially administering the law that when the new specific income limits were enacted in 1989, that everybody assumed that that had superseded this old test. And so what the bill does is to simply repeal it retroactive to enactment of the specific income limits, and imposes a square footage limit on the amount of commercial property that can be included in a housing district, which occurs in a later section. Section 3 just cleans up the definition of tax increment to be a little bit clearer. The last, if you'll see the bullets there, I won't go through all of the details on that. If anybody has questions, I can talk to the specifics. Section 4 is a provision that was suggested as a result of meeting with the State Auditor's Office, that they recommended essentially giving cities a little more flexibility in the TIF plan and identifying the parcels of property that are to be acquired, to make it clear that you don't have to absolutely have every parcel number and ID listed. You can identify them by area or by name and that sort of thing. Section 5 just requires the TIF plan to be filed with the state auditor. Section 6 is an effort by the state auditor to simplify reporting. It eliminates three items that are duplicative or otherwise not used on the financial reports. Section 7 makes a few clarifying changes in the excess increment statute. This statute was significantly rewritten in 2003, and this sort of finishes that process by eliminating some issues that were raised as a result of the rewrite. Sections 8 and 9 are again part of that housing district changes that I indicated before. Section 10 repeals the highest set of income limits on rental properties, what's called the 50-80 income test. Section 11 is an effort to calculate, or to make it easier to calculate the extent to which you can pool to eliminate deficits that were caused by property tax reform. This is done through allowing an optional, simpler calculation for authorities that elect not to issue new debt. And again, that came as a result of suggestions from the state auditor. Sections 12, 13, and 14 are simply fixing cross-references that were not corrected when the statute was amended. There are a couple of provisions in the author's amendment as well. There's one that provides that property in an agricultural processing zone that was also in a pre-existing tax increment district does not qualify for the property tax exemption. That addresses a specific situation in Representative Magnus's district where the local officials did not realize that by applying for the egg processing district, they effectively eliminated the tax increment. And there's also another couple of cross-reference fixes in the author's amendment. The rest of the TIF bill, as Representative Abrams indicated, are special laws that were brought forward by individual members.
Mr. Chairman, I did want to mention in Article 1 there was additional revenue bond authority given to the IRRRA in the amount of $15 million for a variety of school-related purposes that are repaid through by the production tax revenues in the environmental Taconite Environmental Protection Fund, and that came from the Iron Range delegation. On the specific TIF proposals, I can go through them quickly. I'm sure that if you really want to get bored, we do have people here who can talk to them. The first one deals with the City of Brooklyn Center, in which they have struggled mightily to complete activities within their couple of their TIF districts in the Brookdale area, and all that this does is it gives them additional time to comply with the five-year rule, and they have been working diligently, and they've had a couple developers that have crashed and burned on them, and it appears to me to be reasonable. Section 16 is a bill, is a provision that was in last year's bill that dealt with the post office in Fairmont and gives it abatement authority with some other language. Section 17 was in the bill last year that dealt with the city of Wabasha. Part of what they're caught with is that they certified a district too early, and in 1 year they collected $4 of increment. In the second year they collected $0 of increment. So what we're doing is we're going to restart the clock and a couple of other provisions that go along with that. Section 18, which I know probably caused heart attacks among a lot of DFL members in the Richfield and Bloomington area. I think that after about 5 years, we finally have reached an agreement on a housing or redevelopment TIF district that is extraordinarily narrowly defined for the new south-south runway. And it's not without some consternation, but I do believe that the area has been geographically limited to the 60 dB area, which was not the case in the past, and the rules have been tightened quite a bit from where it was. Section 19 is probably in this article the most controversial provision dealing with the city of Mounds View, dealing with the new Medtronic campus, or the provision there, the bill is introduced, wanted to create a redevelopment district from a golf course. I don't think anybody was quite comfortable with that outside of whoever signed it. What we have done is we have allow the City of Mounds View to establish one or more economic development districts that are subject to some special rules. Representative Westerberg, it also will affect the City of Blaine. So this is a freeloader problem also, in that Mounds View is going to be taking all of the risk and doing all of it, and the City of Blaine will be getting a substantial advantage. You can put the City of Mounds View on your Christmas card list after this. There's a duration extension for this economic Development District to 25 years. Given the magnitude of the project, it appears to me to be reasonable to change the five-year rule to a 10-year rule. It does have limits on spending outside, that the limits on spending increments outside the districts do not apply, but the increments must be spent on activities within a defined geographic area. And that's where Blaine comes in, because some increment will be generated in Mounds View and will be spent in Blaine, as I understand it. It limits the uses on the increments. The increments may only be spent on certain activities, one of which has caused me more than a little bit of heartburn, which is the billboards. The others have been granted exceptions in the past, but the billboard situation is somewhat problematic. That is Mounds View, and then I believe the other one is City of Minneapolis in the... First, we're repealing the three-year knockdown rule because it is notorious for never have been enforced and nobody quite knowing what the three-year knockdown rule means. But that section also includes a special law duration limitation on the Sears District that was created in 1997. That wasn't in the thing. I remember this when it was created. Under the special law, the limitation was a shorter of 30 years or 18 years after the receipt of the first increment. The reason that we are doing this is that general law provides that redevelopment districts may collect increments up to 25 years after receipt of the first increment. By repealing the special law, it is better for the City of Minneapolis and keep the special law in. Article 3 is the International Economic Development Zone for the Air Cargo Facility. It's one of the few times in which I have heard a Senate author say that the House language is preferable to the Senate language, and I heard that from Senator Ress. What it does is that it is for air cargo in the facilities to be built probably in the Rosemont area. Why don't I bring Mr. Anderson forward for a short presentation, not to exceed 7 minutes, Mr. Chairman, and he'll be able to answer any questions about the air freight district.
Not to exceed 5 minutes.
5 minutes is better. Three would be even better.
Two. Okay. I think...
are there any questions, Mr. Chairman? Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Maury Anderson, and I'm here representing the Foreign Trade Zone Commission today. And basically, what this legislation does is provide a number of tax incentives that are very consistent with or very similar to what was provided in the Job Z zones. But it is specifically designated to one zone for international trade development and the development of the regional distribution center. And there are probably three reasons for doing this, and one of those is simply allowing Minnesota businesses and Minnesota itself to be cost competitive or competitive in the global marketplace as this global marketplace tends to sort itself out around air cargo as well as other shipping issues. And in the process, it then allows businesses to be more cost competitive in Minnesota. There is a huge cost escalation going on worldwide in businesses that are involved in global business. And if you don't have facilities available, they're going to move where those facilities are because there are huge cost advantages in doing that. And the third aspect of this is really the continuing and changing security environment all around the cargo issues and air transport. And this affords us an opportunity, I think, to be on the cutting edge and leading edge in dealing with security issues for air cargo. All of those would be very positive for Minnesota and Minnesota businesses.
Representative Anderson.
Is this the Osmond bill?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't know if it's the Osmond bill. This is a bill that does, that will create the air cargo district within the city of Rosemont. I know he's a co-author of the bill. I know he's supportive. I know that there are a number of groups who are supportive. I believe even the AFL-CIO is supportive of this. Representative Anderson.
Representative Anderson. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Representative Anderson.
The omnibus bill that I'm referring to dealt with the cities of Duluth, International Falls, and Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, separate bill. Different bill.
Any further questions? Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think this will be for Representative Abrams. Is individual income tax exempt under the job zone legislation?
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stephen, it provides that income derived from investing in or operating a qualified business in the International Economic Development Zone is exempt from individual income tax, and that is Section 2 of Article 3, Representative Stephen.
Representative Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abrams, I was asking, is that similar provision to the job zone legislation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sieben, yes. And, the answer is yes.
Representative Sieben.
Well, Mr. Speaker, and I guess this is just a general comment, it would seem to me that we want to provide businesses with the incentive to invest in this zone, and it's just another additional subsidy to provide the individual investors a subsidy to invest in the zone. You know, you're exempting them from their personal income and capital gains, and that just seems a little excessive to me.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, 2 points. The first point is that I have not seen ever in the legislature a but-for test that like this. But for having incentives like this, this facility will not be built. This is different than Job Z, in which I agree with some of the concerns I've heard over the years. As a matter of fact, I used to lead those arguments that all you're doing is shifting it around. But let me tell you one way in which this is different, in that there is a credit that is a refundable jobs credit that is available, but that is available only for payroll jobs that exceed $30,000 per FTE. So part of the incentive, and I would suggest a very major part of the incentive, in the airport zone legislation, Representative Sieben, answer some of the concerns about making sure that these incentives are available to for higher paying jobs and not just minimum wage type jobs.
Further discussion, Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, I'm going to go back over the same turf because maybe it's my head cold, but I'm not getting it. I understand, I may not always agree, but I understand the logic of providing tax incentive for businesses in a situation like this. I would think that those incentives would then act as inducements to investors to invest in those firms because the firms presumably are getting a competitive advantage. I don't then understand why we're additionally incenting the investors by giving them tax-free income. It's two scoops of ice cream. And I'm thinking these days the state can barely afford one. Depending on what's on top.
I like ice cream.
No, me too. Don't get me wrong.
Here's the but-for test, Representative Dabney and members. Currently, all of the large shipments by air freight, not all, but a very large percentage, are being flown into O'Hare and trucked up. And that's putting our businesses in Minnesota at somewhat a competitive disadvantage in that they have to truck down to Chicago. Now, in order to, and there is some stuff going out in bellies of airplanes, but not much. The idea behind this is that you will have a air cargo handling facility that will literally shave days off of the coming and going to and from Chicago. So it is critical for Minnesota businesses. And secondly, what this gets you is that you're going to have 747 fully loaded freighter 747s and the like going into MSP. And all you need is one or two of these a day. And it amounts to $100, $200 million a year of increased economic activity in the state. So without the facility, as opposed to a lot of stuff that happens in Job Z, without the facility, you aren't going to get that sort of velocity of goods coming in and out. So in that situation, as much as, you know, I killed Job Z 3 years in a row. I set the record. And I made a promise that maybe I shouldn't have made to the governor when he was majority leader. But I can argue that this is a necessary incentive not only to attract the facility to the state, but also for the velocity of economic activity that comes from the facility.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abrams.
Representative Abrams, I'm asking Professor Abrams to work with me here. Let's try an intellectual but-for test. Are you contending that but for the incentives, the incentive of tax-free investment income to private investors in this trade zone, that the companies and the economic activity that you talked about there will not happen? That if me sitting on my fat butt in front of my computer buying 100 shares of DHL or UPS or whoever, knowing that that's tax-free, but for that knowledge, that activity wouldn't happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, in this circumstance, the answer is not only yes, but a resounding yes. If you talk to, you currently have an infrastructure in place which says, we are going to take this material and we are going to ship it to Chicago, or we are going to take the raw materials or whatever, or the semi-manufactured materials, and ship it to Chicago and truck it to Minneapolis, or it's not only Minneapolis, it's throughout the state. This takes 2 or 3 days off of the distribution chain, but there just isn't enough stuff here that if you were looking for the type of capital investment, which is several hundred millions of dollars, that it will not occur but for the incentive that is out there. I'm absolutely convinced, Representative Dabney. And again, I've been wrong in the past. As a matter of fact, I am not even convinced that if you do this, that you will necessarily get the facility. What I am convinced of is that without these incentives, you have no chance of getting the facility. And in a world in which you're having literally same time arrival and same time departure, of inventories, we are at a competitive disadvantage unless we are one of the 4, 5, 6 places in the country that has a facility like this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Further questions? Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, what are all the other facilities in the country done this way with all these exemptions? Or do they just have certain... I thought I had read that they had the certain exemptions, but not this type of income and everything and investment exemptions.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mallory, let me just give you a very quick breakdown of what appears to be occurring with tax credits elsewhere. California allows for an operating loss carry forward for 15 years, $23,400 tax credit for each employee in their zones, sales tax credit up to $20 million, upfront expensing of depreciable property,
Unused tax credits can roll forward, and tax credits for research and development associated with this. Illinois is income tax credits, real estate sales, utility credits, job credit, and then they also provide direct grants, which we are not asking for. Tennessee is very similar also with direct grants. Texas is sales and franchise tax with direct grants for infrastructure and capital funding. North Dakota is actually building a facility. I don't know what theirs are. And just yesterday I read that they're looking at a multimodal facility somewhere in the Kansas City area. I don't know what the credits associated with that would be. But those are some examples of what is going on around the country. And so our credits are pretty competitive, but they don't go quite as far as some of the others do, particularly in the grant area.
Further questions? If not, any further questions on this article? Members, let's revert back to amendments. The chair would move the handwritten amendment that you have in front of you, hopefully. Page 17, lines 22 to 25, delete the new language. Page 17, line 26, strike in and insert outside of. This is the discussion we had previously about the exempting these bonds for use of construction of light rail outside of the Hiawatha Corridor. Any further discussion to the amendment? Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, motion fails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, got the would move the 916 amendment.
Representative Lesh moves the 916 amendment to the amendment. Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, members, this is right on the back, the operative language at the top of the line on page 2, top of the page. This is for the purpose of determining tax increments and parcels treated as tax-paying increments. Each sub-district shall be treated as a separate tax increment district. Briefly, what happened in St. Paul is you've got different uses in the same districts. There are three districts in St. Paul. There's some commercial, some residential, and we're having a problem with timelines. All this does is allows for the city of St. Paul to not have a headache for purposes of accounting and how they have to report separately for each one of these paying parcels inside the district. So it's pretty technical.
Representative Abrams to the 916 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I support the amendment.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Just a moment now. Let's.
Aye.
The opener isn't until what time? Okay. Okay. Any further discussion to the 916 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the 916 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, motion fails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, did you say fails?
Prevails.
It always
prevails.
Sounds like
fails. You want it?
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Okay,
is adopted. Okay.
You can hardly ever hear it.
Okay. Other amendments.
What?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I actually have two. They'll look kind of the same. It's just that the cities are, there's two separate cities here. And what this does in the cities of Preston and Chatfield, there was, these smaller towns have TIF districts and there's not all that many projects in them. And what happened in this case, when the state took over the education funding, the money coming in through the taxes through the county, they're split up between the county and the school district and the city. When we took over the education, more of the education funding, what it did was it made it so there wasn't enough money in the TIF district to pay the bonds back. And what we're trying to do here is we're trying to recapture some of that. There's a project in Preston, there's a project in Chatfield that need this done. And I'd appreciate your support and stand for any questions.
Representative Davids moves the 1624 amendment,
and Mr.
same
Chairman,
as the language in House File number 1624. Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, there should be another one. We probably do them both at the same time. This is the one you have is for Preston. There should be one for Chatfield. Very, basically the same situation.
Well, let's do them one at a time, Mr.
Like I said, I'd like to move this amendment as it is.
Okay. Representative Maury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Davids, I remember when you got a big grant out of here to create a music library in Chatfield. Has this got anything to do with that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm already two separate projects. That was back when I used to be able to get stuff in the bonding bill.
When the Democrats were in charge.
Yeah. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, and to my great friend, Representative Davids, I very rarely oppose you except when you're wrong. And I have to oppose you on this. If we start going down special legislations to exempt districts from the statewide business tax, we're gonna basically upset the entire law in this area. This would be the first one, members, and I would assure you that if we do one, we're going to have to do a whole lot of others. I would strongly recommend a no vote.
Did you want to make one last plea before sentencing, Representative Davis?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to do that, and in all seriousness, these contracts were entered into in good faith, and then the state pulled the rug out from under their contracts, and they're not able to fulfill them. And there'd be very little cost to the state on this, on this one and the one in Chatfield. And just think about what we did here. These TIF districts were set up, and the payment schedules were set up. We changed the law by taking this a lot of the school off the tax statement there, and so they couldn't recover those increments. And I really think, you know, some of the bigger cities have enough TIF districts where they could, or different districts where they could spread it out, and then they were okay. The smaller towns really got caught here and really left a big problem for some of these small town banks that went into contracts in good faith, and then we just changed the contract on. We didn't change the contract on. We just said we're not going to give you the money to pay the contract off. And this would take care of that, and I'd appreciate your support.
Further discussion. Representative Abrams?
You know what a solution may be, and I'll talk to Representative Lincheski and Mr. Michael after this amendment's defeated. But
not looking good, Mr. Chairman.
A possible solution is just come sitting in the chair. We may want to look at doing a duration extension for these districts for this problem, which may take care of it, thinking about it. But I want to think about it, figure out if it doesn't create another problem. But that may be a problem. That may be a solution, Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, at that point, that the cities have been working very closely, that the two cities with the banks in these cases, and they've extended to some, but I believe they've extended as far as they can. But I'll tell you what, I'm feeling some love here, and I think it'd be in my best interest, Mr. Chairman and members, to withdraw both of my amendments and try to work this out, because if we can extend these districts to make this work, that would be a very good thing and a very fair thing to correct the problem that was created inadvertently by what happened in a previous bill. So with that, I will withdraw this and don't hand the other one out, and I'll work on this in the way.
Representative Davids.
My tail between my leg, and I'm running as fast as I can.
Representative Davids withdraws the 1624 amendment. Representative Anderson moves the 912 amendment. Representative Anderson.
This is a tilt amendment for Lake Woods County, Roseville County, and Delphine County. It involves 15,000 acres of land that will get built in.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I kind of find myself in the position of supporting the provision that was in the 2004 tax bill, and I encourage Representative Anderson to put it in the 2005 tax bill. I have reason to believe that I'll be a conferee. I understand it's in the Senate tax bill. Representative Anderson is my word that I will fight for this provision in the Tax Conference Committee enough, Representative Anderson. But I am concerned that we don't rebuild the second tax bill through the public finance bill, Mr. Chairman, which is a concern I know you have too.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Anderson,
I have doubts that there's going to be a tax bill.
Oh,
what a thing to say to the tax chair.
Representative, Representative Anderson, I have already chastised the Senate chair of the Tax Committee that the Senate didn't even take up a concurrence on the wonderful work that the House did. So, but we are not going to treat the Senate like that, Representative Anderson. We will take up the Senate bill for concurrence, I hope. So, anyway. So, Representative Abrams, you don't believe we need this provision in the public finance bill?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. We've already voted for it once.
Okay. Some of us voted for it. All those in favor of the 9-12 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed?
No.
The motion does not fail. The amendment is not adopted. The next amendment, Representative Rukavina moves the A4 amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, this was one that Representative Dill had offered on the tax bill, and what it basically does is just tweaks the way that the Environmental Protection Fund dollars, what they can be spent on up at the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. In the past, we, and Representative Hall's sat on the board, so he's aware of this. We had quite a few public works projects every year, and the commissioner has decided not to do public works projects, even though it's always been one of the mainstays of the agency, due to the fact that this money would otherwise be local tax dollars. So we thought we've missed out a lot on a lot of matching dollars, especially from the feds, on things like airport projects and sewer and water projects, and that's all this intends to do, is make sure that we can emphasize that the board would like to do public works. We still intend to do economic development projects, but we have to try to keep our infrastructure somewhat maintained up there also because of the effects of mining. So I'd appreciate your support on it.
Representative Abrams.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I feel like we're getting into an argument between the IRRRB and the IRRRA and the IRRR whatever is between the board and the commissioner, and would recommend a no vote. I think that the it should be for economic development, and whatever differences members of the board have with the commissioners are better taken care of up north than in St. Paul. So I would recommend a no vote.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Rukavina,
quickly, that's what I'm trying to do, is take care of them, period. And rather than end up in a big fight, just have the ability to, as I said, members, we don't, and if you look at a lot of other, a lot of other mining areas around the country, they don't have, there's a lot of Appalachians all over, whether it's the UP of Michigan or Bisbee, Arizona, wherever, so we don't want that problem in our area. And Mr. Chair, Representative Abrams, with all due respect, the commissioner has gotten off on a new policy. We are still on the same course, so I would hope Representative Hollison could convince a few of his friends over there to help me, because he's seen that we are not frivolously spending money up there. Appreciate your support, members.
Representative Rukavina, you and the governor on good terms now, bad terms? I have trouble following your ongoing relationship with the former majority.
I think when he asked me to be a minnow in his boat, to that, you know, maybe perhaps the relationship still hasn't.
Representative Rukavina, I did talk to Mr. McElroy yesterday, and I think he's lining up a replacement for the rumble in the rotunda on his part. He said something about his good friend Mike Oskop substituting.
That's so okay. Anyway. That's there.
Okay. We'll sell tickets and help help finance state government. Anyway. Further discussion to the A4 amendment? Further discussion? All those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed?
No. No.
The motion does. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Member.
I'm not sure, but I think from the lot that
you've done, just put it off.
Third reading.
The Representative Cronin moves the A3 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is a performance bond waiver or an alternative. It's for a solid waste facility project in Redwood County, and with the, if it's okay with the chair, Mr. Barry Tilley has some more information on the amendment.
Mr. Tilley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barry Tilley. I'm here representing Barlow Systems, a developer of waste energy facilities. Barlow Systems is working with a group of nine counties in southwestern Minnesota to build a waste energy facility that will be located in Lamberton in an industrial park that will provide generate use the facility to burn garbage to generate electricity and steam heat to serve the industrial park. What we are seeking here, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is a waiver from the laws that govern performance bonds in this area. What has happened since 9/11 is that the availability of these performance bonds, for whatever reason, has become very difficult to do. When you can get them, they're very, very expensive. Because the cost of the performance bond will be built into the project, and will be have to be paid for the counties, we are proposing here that to in if we are granted this waiver ability, the equipment in this facility will be privately financed by Barlow Systems, will not be the financial responsibility of the counties until such time that the equipment meets the performance standards demanded by the county to serve this. The cost of these bonds this performance bond would be in excess of $3, maybe $4 million. The total project's only about $37 million. So we are seeking this waiver to make the project more cost effective. The project, the building will be eventually financed by revenue bonds, and which will be retired by the tipping fee and the revenues realized from the sale of electricity and steam for the facility.
Thank you. Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, my good friend Representative Kuhn and I have to oppose the amendment. I think it is a real slippery slope when we start waiving requirements for performance bonds. I understand the issue regarding financial acceptance, but you know, the day we're in here waiving it for facilities under 115A or Chapter 400, I'm afraid next year we'll be in the same room with the Public Finance Institute wanting to waive performance bonds for all construction projects. And I think that there are enough former mayors and county commissioners and city council members in the room to understand what a slippery slope this could possibly be. And that's why I oppose it. I don't oppose the facility. It could be made better if it burned tires, but I don't oppose the facility.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if there are further safeguards that you would like to add, we are more than happy to deal with that. We are trying to minimize the cost to the county for this facility, and we are willing to work with whatever safeguards you might like to impose on this.
I think the safeguard is not to put it in statute. The Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman, talking about safeguards, I would just advise my good friend Representative Conan that don't talk to any of your local mayors on tape, and don't use any lines from Eddie Murphy movies. And my question is, does this facility burn waste tires? In all seriousness.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davids, no, it's designed to burn MSW, municipal solid waste. Waste tires are prohibitive for going into the MSW waste stream.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Further discussion. Further discussion to the A3 amendment. Further discussion. All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed?
No.
The amendment does not, motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Thank you for consideration.
We have I have a I have a 922 amendment.
Chair, that was Representative Dills.
That was Representative Dills.
He asked if I present it. It's in two bills that left the House, but he feel better about it being in here, and it has the actually the governor's office does not oppose this.
Well, that always makes me feel so much better.
Nor any of us. Yes, I know, Mr. Chair.
What is it?
Just so Representative, what it does is allows for early retirement of approximately five employees at Iron Range Resources.
Well, Chairman.
Yeah, Representative Rukavina, what does this have to do with the public finance bill?
Well, we're financing it up there, public. We have to put money in up front to allow for the early retirement. So it's financing public money for the retirement.
Well, Representative Rukavina, if you're looking for another if you're looking for another vehicle, I would suggest that maybe the public pension bill might be a little closer to germane for the issue, since it's dealing with incentive programs for early retirement. But so, Representative Rukavina, I think that it better belongs, as I said, on the pension legislation than on the public finance bill.
Okay, Mr. Chair. For another vehicle.
There's still a few trains leaving the station. Thank you, Representative Rukavina. I appreciate that. Okay.
Yeah.
The A6 amendment, Representative Vanderveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just to make better policy out of a sales tax decision made on the tax bill. And what it does is it just requires that a city that imposes a local sales tax apportion that to the adjacent, any contiguous city or township by population. And I think we should have a roll call on this, Mr. Chair.
How much does Blooming have?
Representative Dabney.
Representative Krenke, Representative Vanderveer, I'm just trying to understand this. So under the tax bill that left the House, Minneapolis is cut $18 million in LGA and is required to have a referendum on a half-cent sales tax. Would it then be required under this amendment to share the proceeds of that half-cent sales tax if approved by the voters with Bloomington, Richfield, Coon Rapids, Edina,
Walker,
so on and so forth.
Representative Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Baker has indicated that that is not my intent, and it's my understanding that that is not what would happen.
Ms. Baker, you want
to... Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, the way Representative Vanderveer's amendment is written, it says any city imposing a local sales tax under general law, and Minneapolis sales tax, the existing Minneapolis sales tax, and all of the existing local sales taxes are enacted under special laws, and including the tax bill that passed that identifies. Because it wasn't done for all first-class cities, but only for Minneapolis and St. Paul, that would be a special law that applies to those cities. So what this would affect are the cities who, assuming the Dorn Amendment, for example, became law, and those cities that exercised that authority would then be subject to this.
Thank you, Paul.
And I believe, Mr. Schmeichel, we have one thing, is that language that was in the bill, the House tax bill, prohibited the general imposition of sales, local option sales tax in the 7-county metro area also.
Mm-hmm.
So, Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, as much as I may like the policy, I think it's maybe the right policy but the wrong bill. And I have no desire to rebuild a second omnibus tax bill. I'd like to carry an omnibus public finance bill, so I would recommend a no vote.
With all.
Okay. Further discussion to the A6 amendment. Representative Dorman.
have a question for Representative Vandeveer. As I think about this, I wonder if you'd be open to changing this a little bit so that a resident of a contiguous township or city that earned income in that other city would then have to pay an income tax or something to that city so that this city or township, the city could recover the money from the person who earns an income in the city but then goes out into the township. For example, me. My store sits in the city of Albert Lea. I live in Albert Lea Township. And so if the city of Albert Lea would share the sales tax with my township, maybe then I should be sharing my income tax with the city. Is that kind of what you're thinking here?
You could incorporate that, couldn't you?
I think under current law, you probably could share as much as you wanted with them, but... anyway, Representative Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, if a city's going to act like a state, then your theory is correct. But we don't have a sales or an income tax, and I don't wish to start a new one here. That would be too complicated, and I think Representative Abrams is a little worried about his bill getting big now, and I wouldn't want to make it any bigger.
It would greatly expand the scope of the bill.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Speaker Davids.
Great.
No. Okay, further discussion to the A6 amendment. Representative Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Vandeveer, I tend to agree with your concept. I was opposed to the Dorn Amendment, but, actually, I agree with Representative Abrams. I don't think it's probably for this bill, but I don't know if this actually goes far enough in that, we've got small cities 30, 40, 50 miles away from a regional center that would be impacted, and only going to the contiguous townships and cities wouldn't really, I don't think, get to what you're trying to do. I agree with your concept, but it's probably not going far enough, but I agree with Representative Abrams as far as this is the bill, and I'll be voting no.
Okay, further discussion to the A6 amendment? Any further discussion, Representative... Representative Vandeveer, did you want a roll call vote?
I did ask for one, Mr. Chair. I think we do. There aren't many vehicles that this would fit onto. I think this might be the only one, or else I...
This might be the last train leaving the station. Okay. The clerk will take the roll. The chair votes no.
Abrams.
No.
Anderson.
No.
Atkins.
No.
Bernardi.
No.
Broad. Davids.
Respectfully, no.
Dabney.
No.
De La Forest. Dill. Dorman.
No.
Earhart. Howes.
Yes.
Yaros.
Aye.
Knobloch. Coonan.
Aye.
Coles.
I like it, but no.
Lanning.
No.
Lencheski.
No.
Lesch.
No.
Yeah.
Marquardt. Yeah.
No.
Mullery. Nelson. Rukavina.
Sympathetic, yes.
Stevens.
No.
Simpson.
No.
Vandeveer?
Yes.
Westerberg?
I don't like it, no.
Sellers?
Is it going to be close?
Yes, I'll give them a second.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
You like you?
I know.
There being 6 ayes and 18 nays, the motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair? Over here.
I'm sorry. Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if I brought it with me or not, but I planned on offering an amendment that would have created a statewide fiscal disparities pool. Kind of thinking along the lines that Representative Vandeveer was, but seeing how that vote went, I think I'm not going to offer it. So I just wanted you to rest assured that I'm not offering the statewide fiscal disparities pool legislation onto it.
Thank you.
Well, Representative Dorman, beyond Ways and Means, you might have an opportunity again. So. Representative Simpson.
I wonder if we shouldn't have done a call of the House on that so that we make sure everybody got the chance to vote, because it seems like the crowd is getting thinner and thinner, and I'm still here.
I'm not getting thinner.
Okay. The further discussion to the House File 2498 as amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion. Representative Andrew.
Thank you. Representative Abrams, I don't remember you talking about this. Maybe you did, and if you did, I apologize. On page 13, line 4, you're going from 30 to 35 years. And on line 6, you insert 40. You've got 40 years. That's how long these bonds are going out for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Vandeveer, yes, and these are in limited circumstances for housing to finance the obligation sold for the elderly, and I forgot the other section that you have cited, but what has happened, Representative Vandeveer and members, is that a market has developed for these longer bonds. It is used in a number of other jurisdictions, and it doesn't appear to harm anything, and it just is another financing product that's available. Representative Vandeveer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abrams, this 40 years is quite a long time to go out. Maybe we can talk about it more between here and Ways and Means, but thank you.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Chairman Krenke and Representative Abrams. I know you're aware of this, but I just wanted to get it on the record that Representative Pawlowski had a concern that the bill he has for Winona is not included, and had some quick discussions with Representative Abrams after session today, and I know that Representative Abrams had committed to see if there was something that could be done, at least try to look again before Ways and Means, and Mr. Michaels will be speaking with Winona, I believe, this afternoon. But I also wanted to call the attention to Representative Abrams, who was unable to speak with Representative Osmonds because you're presenting the bill, who came in the room, who is still concerned about trying to get his Rosemount provision into the public finance bill. And I think you and I had both thought there were problems there, but he's open to new ideas as well, and just asked that the committee be made aware of that, that there might be some other efforts to be pursued for Representative Osmond before the bill goes to Ways and Means.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, I'll certainly listen to Representative Pawlowski and Representative Osmond. On the other hand, both of those provisions have significant major policy changes in them. I believe particularly the Osmond provision, at least what I have heard, would be pooling way outside of a district, and if pooling rules aren't good for some abusers in the past, I'm not going to point out names, but if pooling rules are no good for some, they, you know, I have a real problem in saying that they're good for others, but I'm certainly looking at Representative Osmond to see if we can develop alternatives, as well as Representative Pawlowski.
Further discussion to the bill? If not, Representative Abrams renews his motion that House File 2498, as amended, be recommended to pass, be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those who are opposed, the motion fails. And bill's passed. Thank you, Representative Abrams. Thank you, members. I do have... Representative Vandeveer would have approval, would move the approval of minutes from...
I have a question on the minutes.
Okay, just let's let them move, move approval of minutes from the April 12th, April 20th, May 2nd, and May 3rd meeting. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did you say May 2nd?
May 2nd is...
I have the 20th, 27th, 28th in front of me.
I'm sorry.
May 2nd, 3rd, 27th, 28th, and 20th. Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and
Mr. Chair, April 12th is stapled to the back of April 28th.
Members, we'll just okay. Take care of it we'll just take care of the minutes at the next meeting. I did want to try to get those approved. Mm-hmm. And members and anyone in the audience, apologize for not getting to House File 2228. That's the recodification from the Department of Revenue. We'll take it up the first thing at our meeting on Monday, and then we'll take up the gambling provisions for the gambling, Representative Gunther's gambling bill after that. So, with that, members, meeting is adjourned.